no one's seen success coming. So the fact that we all got to experience the huge explosion of just popularity in real time, it's definitely something that will probably stand with me for the rest of my life.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast, your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. I have a great episode for you today, so let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice. Today's guest is James Brady, a talented freelance artist. He's worked on games like PUBG, Hitman 2, Red Dead Redemption 2, Insurgency Sandstorm, Firewall Zero Hour, Halo, Last Year the Nightmare, The Forest, and many others. He's based out of Ireland and currently working for a studio here in the US remotely. He's been in-house working at places like Rockstar, remotely as a freelancer, and been in the industry for 4 years now. Okay, let's kick things off now with James. Okay, I've got James here today. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Thanks.
Cool. Let's start off with the first question. Tell me about what your current role is right now.
Yeah, sure. So at the moment, I'm a full-time freelancer. I'm working on 4 different projects at the moment between European and American companies. And
Okay. Can you just mention those 4 games, if possible? If not, that's fine too.
So basically, I'm working on Not My Car, which is a battle royale game made by an indie studio in California. Pretty much just the same principles as PUBG, except you're in cars. You know, you jump out of the plane in cars, and you have to loot and find weapons and survive. The other projects, unfortunately, I can't disclose due to NDAs.
Yeah, no, it's totally fine. But all right, another battle royale. But the twist is now it's in cars. Interesting. So, how'd you get started in the video game industry? Kind of talk me through it.
Sure. So, I started off in 2015. I had the opportunity to join Creative Assembly as a QA tester on Total War Warhammer. And then I moved over from Ireland to England to join them, and I worked there for the guts of a year. We shipped Total War Warhammer, including 2 DLC releases. And in that time, I kind of was wanting to progress more into like an artist role. And I seen that Rockstar Games were hiring a junior artist in the UK studio. So I applied, and then I ended up working at Rockstar for 12 months on Red Dead Redemption 2. And then
little game. Nobody's heard of that. Was that in Edinburgh, right? Or no, where was that?
So they have a studio in Leeds, which is like one of the art support studios for the main studio in Edinburgh.
Okay.
Smaller team. It's about 80 in total. Smaller studio. Mm-hmm. So I essentially joined them to kind of just help like on the art front with the project.
Right. Yeah. I always found it interesting. Like a lot of the real early Grand Theft Autos were developed in Edinburgh, Scotland, which was kind of funny because they had such an American flair to them that they were developed over in Scotland.
Yeah, exactly. I know that they have a studio in New York and San Diego. I think the New York one's just a publisher, but I know San Diego like do all development.
Yeah, San Diego's a huge studio from what I know. And New York's more the publishing arm. All the suits and whatnot are there, but yeah, there's a big studio down in out west there in San Diego. Keep talking through. It's after Red Dead and Rockstar. Then what?
Yeah, so essentially the summer of 2017, I seen that the guys working on PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds were hiring an environment artist, At the time of Rockstar, I was kind of doing more like junior art tasks, so there wasn't as much art per se involved. A lot of it was just optimization and kind of doing like polish passes in like areas of the map. So I kind of at that point was like, you know, I really want to jump in and kind of get my hands dirty and just like fully fledged art. And I seen that the Madison studio for PUBG were hiring an environment artist. So I reached out to them and I was like, hey guys, you know, I'm been looking at the project, it looks really great. You know, I would love to join you guys as an environment artist. And then they got back to me and they were like, yeah, for sure. Like, they're super interested, but the only issue is immigration. So we had a lot of back and forth trying to see if there was any opportunities for me to actually get a visa to move to Madison. Unfortunately, at the end, there wasn't. So they were like, okay, well, we'll take you on as a remote artist. And you give the initial contract to 6 months. So the summer of July, then I left Rockstar to go work in PUBG. And at this time, I kind of was like, oh, well, I guess I'm a freelancer now, you know? It literally was a case of I left Rockstar, I started on PUBG, and we started Bashline Art for Miramar, the desert map that came out later that year. During that time, I was still living in Leeds, so I decided to relocate back to Ireland and to be closer to my family. And since then, I've essentially just been freelancing. The projects I've been freelancing have been PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, Forest, Hitman 2, Firewall Zero Hour, Vigor, Insurgency Sandstorm, Last Year of the Nightmare, among many, many more projects. I've probably worked on at least 22, 23 in total between in-house and AAA.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot considering, that's really a lot considering the amount of time you've been in the industry to have that many titles under your belt. I'm just really kind of interested in that story about, you know, being from a small town in Ireland and getting into the game industry. So like, what games did you play when you were young and what were your aspirations, you know, to get started?
Yeah, so sure. I'll go back, right back to drawing crayons with crayons. You know, for me, it was kind of, you know, it started, I was living with my parents. My dad worked in a graphic design company. And when I was like three, he would sneak me in to play video games. It was like cookies and orange juice. And the first game we played was Marathon from Bungie.
Oh, yeah.
And we also played Syndicate, which I think the company was Bullfrog.
Yeah.
And that kind of really like, that kind of kickstarted my interest in video games. And then later we got the PlayStation 1. My mom bought my dad it and it was Tekken. You know, I seen that and it kind of just, I guess just the visual fidelity of it kind of blew me away. And kickstarted my interest in games. But from a very young age, I had absolutely no intentions of being an artist in the games industry. So later on, throughout my years, in my younger teen years, I was at school and we had like art class. And because my dad does a lot of concept art and he's worked on like doing concept art for like World of Warcraft.
Oh, wow.
My teachers would be very much like, you know, oh, you know, your dad's a fantastic artist. You know, there's absolutely no problem. Like, you sure as shit should be able to make something to his, you know, ability.
No pressure.
Yeah. So that just made me absolutely hate the art project, like the whole art, like, class. And I just was like, I never
want to do it. I'm not going to do it because of you, Dad. I'll show you.
My whole initial aspiration was to be a scientist with a bioscience degree. Moving on, like basically fast forwarding from Marathon, when Bungie released Halo, my parents bought me the Xbox. And that was the very first game I played on console. So I got extremely interested, and obviously it was Bungie. And then Halo 2 came out at Christmas, and my parents bought me the anniversary edition with kind of like a making of DVD. And I remember watching the making of DVD, and that kind of just started really turning the gears in my head. Like, holy crap, like this is actually what I want to do. And at that time, I never knew it was 3D art. I just knew I wanted to work in games, and that's all I wanted to do. I had no idea what, you know, discipline. And then kind of later on, I just started. Somehow, I kind of found my way onto Maya and 3ds Max. And I started practicing. And this time, I was still at school. And I went, you know, I kind of thought to myself, okay, well, to get into the games industry, surely you just need a degree. So my options within work, get a degree in the art field were extremely limited because Ireland pretty much had a non-existent games industry at this point. And it was over here, it was seen as a phase and just a hobby. Like you won't make money off it.
It's a pet rock. It's a fad.
Yeah, pretty much. Basically, my only option was to go and get a degree in essentially computer science. So I was like, okay, well, no, because I'm not good at maths. Probably can't code to save my life. So that ain't gonna happen.
You and me both.
Yeah. So basically, it kind of was just, I did a year course after school, high school, which was pretty much like a diploma, like a 1 year diploma in game design, which had like two modules dedicated to that, and the rest were just random topics to kind of just fill it out. So essentially, after assignments, I would kind of start cranking out a 3DS Max in my free time, just kind of learning the modeling tools. I became the kind of go-to person in the class for creating 3D models for any projects that come up. And if they wanted like a demonstration in Unreal Engine 3, which is UDK at that time, of like a emergency exit demonstration for the college. So I was assigned to doing that. And then after that, after I graduated, I kind of flittered for a while throughout like at least 3 or 4 years of kind of being like, okay, I'm going to work on my portfolio and do the art. And then I kind of stick at it for like 3 months and then I'm like, I'll screw this. And I go and, you know, just get a job in a store close by or whatnot and work that. I think it came to about 2015 where I just kind of hit a point where I was like, you know what? Like, I really still want to do this and make this, you know, a viable career and make a reality. I either put the energy and iron focus to get a portfolio to get into a studio, or it's just never happening. So I was working at a call center, so I essentially quit my job, just started busting the nut on a portfolio, doing all nighters, just continuously cranking out the work, even though my work back then was just absolutely terrible. And I was applying to studios. I had art tests and interviews, and I kept getting declined. So I was kind of like, okay, well, maybe I need to take a step down. So I applied to Creative Assembly for the QA tester in Total War Warhammer. And thankfully, I managed to get that. So that was kind of like my foot into the industry.
Yep. That is the way a lot, you know, even still now. I mean, it totally was back 20, 30 years ago. But yeah, QA is a good foot in the industry and it gives you exposure to different disciplines. And you get to kind of, as we say, see how the sausage is made, right? And you get to be part of the process and especially there at the end of it and things like that. So you got into QA and then that was your foothold to then show your portfolio to people and things, or?
Yeah, so essentially during that time, I was friends with a lot of the art team on Facebook, and I was just kind of like, when I got home in the evenings, I continued to work on the art because I knew I essentially just wanted to make art. And they kind of got a whiff of my portfolio and my ability. So they were kind of trying to niggle me into the whole like, hey, bring them on as like a associate environment artist to kind of do more of the art stuff for like Total War. But obviously I had quite a bad time working in QA because there was a bit of a power struggle going on. So they kind of like totally slammed down on that. And they were like, hell no, like you're QA or you're out of here basically. So thankfully I got the opportunity then to take the junior art role at Rockstar. So essentially just transitioned to Rockstar and continued, you know, working on Red Dead Redemption 2. And then in the evenings, continued to work on my portfolio. And, you know, during this time, I was featured in, like, magazines for some of the art I did. And I did a weekend project, which was, like, an Unreal Engine scene of a school. And my friend was like, hey, that actually looks like Silent Hill. So I was just like, oh, screw it, I'll call it Silent Hill. And I posted it online, and it kind of just gained traction of one of those sort of, like, Silent Hill remake in Unreal Engine 4, and within like a week, it was just all over the internet on all the like gaming sites from the US to France to Asia, from like Eurogamer to Destructoid to many more sites. So that was quite crazy because it was absolutely not intentional, and somehow some editor got whiff of the scene and just posted it, and then it just. I literally watched.
Went viral, as they say, right?
Yeah. It was on like Unilab as well and over Facebook, and it was just absolutely insane.
Well, you know, and I give you credit, right? Because you came to a fork in the road and like, am I just going to work in this store and this is, you know, going to be the rest of my life? Or am I going to, you know, double down and put the work in and get my portfolio together? And obviously you're very smart on the internet, right? And using social networks and connecting with people and being able to reach out and ask if people are hiring, and that you're not just being passive about it. You're being very ambitious and aggressive about it. And that's why we're talking today. You reached out to me after listening to the podcast and I looked at your reel and looked at your background. And I was like, wow, this is an interesting story. And I should talk with this guy.
You know, and it's funny because I have a lot of people like over the last probably 12 months, I've kind of just detached myself from the whole noise of the games industry. Like, I wouldn't be friends anymore with people on Facebook, and I kind of closed my LinkedIn down a little bit and have my own personal website, because I find, like, if you're in the bubble for too long, it kind of it becomes toxic very quickly. I've had friends who are like, you know, if you reach out to people for podcasts and magazines and stuff, it's kind of seen as cheating. Like, they have to reach out to you, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. That's another, you know, aspect of the spectrum, I guess.
Yeah, no. And as long as you've got something interesting to share and you've got some a cool reel or a background or portfolio or story, yeah, there's no reason, you know, why people wouldn't have you on. I mean, I reached out to the guys at Game Dev on Unchained, and I was on their podcast last November.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it was, I think, episode 163, something like that. But you have to get out there and you know, without being sleazy or being a pest, but just let people know about you and be visible and do things. And, you know, like your thing going viral, you know, that was a big deal. So, like, had you not done that and taken the time or the initiative to develop that, you know, your story could have changed. And you went from 2015 working at the store to 2017, you're working on PUBG, which, you know, went on to be one of the, you know, the biggest games in this last 5 or 10 years. So yeah, I mean, that's a pretty amazing story.
It's absolutely insane. And I mean, I've literally moved back to Ireland where there's no industry. Well, there is an industry now. I mean, we have like John and Brenda Romero over in Galway, and then we have, like, you know, people from Riot starting up their own studio in Dublin, which is our capital city. But prior to that, it was literally a case like I moved home, and I definitely consider myself to be very lucky where I've moved home and I've continued to work on huge projects. Being in a small little town in the countryside in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. Well, that's cool, right? I mean, that's powerful. It's like you don't have to be in, you know, California or wherever, you know, like the traditional viewpoint is to be in games now, because, you know, the world is flat now.
Exactly.
You know, the internet, for better or for worse, changes the playing field. So
yeah, and the internet makes the world a very small place. I mean, I had job opportunities with Ubisoft in Toronto and Epic in Montreal, and I was very close to taking the leap to actually relocate over to Toronto to work at Ubisoft and Far Cry. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of thought more about it. I was like, you know what? Like, I mean, I've managed to keep this boat afloat for this long as a freelancer working on huge titles, so I kind of just in the end was like, you know what, I'm going to just do that. Big thanks to Ubisoft, but yeah.
Yeah, no, and if it suits your lifestyle and you like being a night owl and then working on multiple projects and, you know, hell, you get a lot more pieces for your portfolio under your belt by freelancing versus, you know, being in a studio working on one game.
Exactly, yeah.
That suits you and no reason why you shouldn't. So, PUBG Battlegrounds, talk me through that. I mean, you know, that had to be pretty amazing to work on and just see this thing just take off on a rocket ship, right? Like, how did that go?
I mean, it was crazy because I remember when I was at Rockstar, I was just at a point where I was so desperate to kind of take on more of an artistic role. And I seen that they were hiring. I actually seen the advertisement on ArtStation, and I never heard of the project before. So I was like, okay. So they gave me the contract and we kicked it off. And at first, I was a little embarrassed to kind of tell people and friends, like, hey, I've actually just quit Rockstar to go work on this little project that, like, nobody's really heard of, you know? And
what are you doing, man? You've lost your mind. You left Rockstar to work in some little project, PUBG? What?
Yeah.
What are you thinking?
You know, I remember, you know, like, I left the studio and I was walking back to my flat, and I was thinking to myself, like, you know, if this fails, I become essentially the water cooler conversation on Rockstar. It's just like, hey, remember that guy who quit? So, yeah, it was crazy. I mean, I remember when we started, it was only, I think it was in beta mode still, I'm not sure, but it was not popular at all. And during the time of working on it, we started to see it slowly pick up traction, you know, and like people like Dr. Disrespect were playing it and streaming it. At this point, it wasn't even the highest played game on Steam. Like, we literally watched it climb from like the middle of the charts right up to the top. And
wow! So, what do you think drove that? I mean, was it the Twitch players and people playing online and people watching others playing get excited about it, or because I mean, there wasn't like a huge advertising push that you see on TV or anything.
There really wasn't. You know, it's people have asked me this before, and it's something I can't really answer. I think it was literally just like a natural phenomenon, kind of just a once-off sort of hit and miss that kind of just the right time at the right place and just kind of gained the traction it gained. I mean, I think the game's pretty fun. You know, I've been playing for like a long time. And when I started playing it, when I started working on it, I started to realize that it was quite, you know, there was always like replayability to it. So like you would never kind of like get bored and you can jump in. And I think it's essentially just down to the fact that you're in a plane with 100 other players around the world. You land on a map and you have to loot and survive. And that can end in any kind of sort of scenario. You know, so there's just always a lot of interesting outcomes. And I think, you know, it's totally like easy to be, to go from the 100th player to the 20th, but then trying to get from the 20th to the last man standing is just like, it's like really, really difficult. And it's that kind of like adrenaline rush moment of just like, oh my God, I have to like kill everyone else and survive. So yeah, I think it definitely provides a lot in that front. But yeah, it was just crazy to see it being, you know, shown off at E3 and Brenton announcing the release on Xbox, and then with Miramar come out, it just kind of seemed to explode, like so much popularity and millions of people playing it. It's just absolutely just insane.
Yeah, it feels kind of like one of those lightning in a bottle moments, right, where it was just this convergence of this kind of gameplay with the environments and like that tension that's inherent to the kind of countdown, like, oh shit, I'm number 19 left. I got to stay alive. And just that the rush you get from trying to be the last one standing. And it had to be amazing just like to see that hockey stick curve of growth where the thing just shot through the roof, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and the thing is, like, when I was working on it, they posted me a PUBG developer t-shirt from E3. Mm-hmm. And on the front, it has like winner, winner, chicken dinner, and it has like hashtag E3. I think it was like 2016, 2017. There'd be days where I kind of just forget how popular the game is and I'd be wearing the t-shirt and I start to kind of, people's heads start to turn and I'm like, oh shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like I came back from GDC last year and I brought home a Fortnite t-shirt, showed it to my sons, and my one son was just like, give me that. I want that shirt now. I'm like, easy, Jack. All right, here you go. You can have the Fortnite shirt. That's cool. So what about advice you would give someone, you know, looking to get their first job in the industry?
So I think it's a wide, very wide question, but to narrow it down, I think the most important thing is to know what it is you want to do in the games industry. You know, is it art? You know, do you have a niche and a flair for sound and music? Can you code? Are you good at design? Do you just want to test the games? You know, it's really kind of like the, starting with the absolute, like the crayons per se, and just knowing exactly what you want to do. And then it's essentially sort of just really honing your abilities and your skills in one specific area. You know, there's no such thing as generalists in the games industry within like the art, you know, category. And I think it's just important to really kind of just to know what you need to do, you know, hone your skills and just practice and making yourself as visible as possible online, you know, in the sense that joining like forums and websites that kind of are dedicated to the ability you want to get good at, like, you know, for artists, it's like Polycount and ArtStation. And getting to know industry people through like social media and LinkedIn, just making everyone aware of, you know, who you are and what you want to do in the industry and just connecting. And, you know, if there's certain studios you want to work at, just add the art directors and such on LinkedIn and be like, hey, I'm a big fan. Are you guys hiring? Especially for artists, it's important to kind of hone your portfolio in their art style for the projects. So if you want to go work in Fortnite, you know, make your portfolio more stylized art that fits with the art direction of Fortnite. If you want to go work in Call of Duty, make it more realistic. I think that's extremely important. And I think also, you know, if it's within the art, category, it's important to kind of know which area you want to specialize in. So that could be environment art, cards art, weapon art. And I think with that, it's extremely important to have your portfolio focusing on just one specific area. You know, no art director wants to open a portfolio for an environment artist that has like five weapons, like three character sculpts and...
Right. And some character drawings and... Right. Yeah, because it does make it hard. You have to put yourself, you know, in the shoes of the other person. It's like, I need to fill an environment artist, so I need to see those portfolios. And if the person opening the portfolio has to then dig around and look and try and find what they're looking for, that's just time that's ticking against you, and they're going to close that tab. So It may even be smart to, you know, when you focus on areas, even have different subsections of your portfolio that you can share that are targeted towards those jobs. Because, you know, the shorter the link is between this is what I do and this is what you're looking for, it's easier for them to go, huh, all right, let's talk to this person for this role. But,
exactly.
You know, I've seen lots of times where people apply for a job and then their portfolio is nothing like what that job description is. So it's like, well, maybe you can, but there's no pieces to show that you can do that. And that's just too much of a leap for a company or, you know, people to take. So you have to really tailor that stuff. I think your point about specializing is important too. Also depending like what kind of games you want to make, you know, AAA versus indie, I think you can be more of a generalist, you know, when it comes to indie stuff. When you get bigger, you know, the AAAs, yeah, then you have to drill down a little bit more and specialize, then tailor your portfolio around that and then approach those kind of companies.
Yeah, exactly. And if I'm like, you know, I mean, our directors only have like a couple of minutes to check portfolios because they have to worry mm-hmm. about our teams and marketing and such. And it's like, if you have a really awesome environment in your portfolio, but you have like other things like character sculpts and whatnot, that just really, really dilutes your best work and it just doesn't let it shine. So, you know, mm-hmm. I always say to people, quality over quantity, you know, the less is more, especially when it comes to people reviewing your portfolios for jobs, because they won't have yeah. time to go through like 25 portfolio pieces. But if you've three fantastic environments or three fantastic weapons for a weapon art job, then boom, like, you know, that gives you a higher yeah. chance.
Yeah, it makes it a closer fit. And then there's less risk and less, let's see what the other portfolios are. And then someone else's portfolio is a better fit. And then you kind of fall off the radar there at that point. Also to your point about ArtStation. Yeah. I know that's a big thing at Level X where I work. And, we're always like, you know, who's that artist? And that's one of the first things, our art director and other artists do is, you know, check what their ArtStation looks like. So yeah, it's important to have your best pieces up there and keep that up to date, because that's very much almost like a, you know, a LinkedIn for artists when it comes to your reel and how you represent yourself on ArtStation says a lot as an artist.
Exactly. I mean, I guess the funny thing is that I used to be on ArtStation, but I closed my ArtStation down and created my own website. And I think it's more just for the fact that as a freelancer, it's like when you approach clients or art directors, sometimes it's kind of a good idea to maybe also just have your own website. If you have enough experience and exposure already, because if you apply to, like, if you work for a client or you're kind of reaching out to a client being like, hey, I would love to do work for you, and you open your ArtStation and see that you're following like 15 other freelancers who are probably even better, then they kind of just dilute your opportunities and chances, you know? So.
Okay, quick question break. What are your thoughts so far? Do you have a topic idea, a question to ask, or a guest suggestion? Let me know at 224-484-7733 or on the gamedevadvice.com website.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't thought of that before. Cool. So what about other ways for people working in the industry as an artist for them to, say, improve and get better?
So I think the most important thing with that is just practice, you know, like practice doesn't beat anything, mm-hmm. you know, there's no easy way around it. It's really just a case that you just have to keep churning out props, churning out weapons in your, you know, in your specific area and just keep practicing and honing your skills and staying up to standard with industry standard tools, you know, like, you know, yeah. be familiar with ZBrush, be familiar with Autodesk software. You know, if there's like extra plugins that make just your life a lot easier when you're modeling, or even if you have an accessible kit bash of just like screws and bolts, a lot of that stuff really mm-hmm. speeds up your workflow process. I think like the most important thing is just keep practicing, you know, like, you know, an hour a night, you know, 5 hours a week, that's enough for a high poly, you know, that's something extra and it's you getting better to making better high poly models.
Yeah, this has to be the passion, right? This has to be where your focus is and what do you obsess about. And, you know, people I work with, they go home and they're up till, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning sometimes working on their own projects and putting together pieces for 80 level or something like that. So it's not a, you know, punch in, punch out and don't think about it again type career path. You always have to be striving and learning and wanting to improve your chops and learning new tools and things. So what's your favorite new art tool that you're working on, you know, package or plugin or thing that kind of jumps out?
So I kind of have two. The first one is UV layout. I use that a lot for my unwrapping. Because I work as a freelancer on multiple projects, it just makes my life so much easier unwrapping, because it's literally like you're literally cutting your mesh up in 3D world space into separate islands, and then you basically, the application optimizes the size of those UV islands according to the mesh and then packs it all for you. So it's literally like 3 hours of unwrapping only takes you 15 minutes. An absolute blessing. Another tool is ZBrush. I do all my Boolean workflow through ZBrush. So like for the weapon mm-hmm. I made on my portfolio, it's the majority of that is all ZBrush. Instead of like subdividing or subdivision modeling in 3ds Max, I just literally bring in ZBrush, cut loads of holes and everything out of it, and dynamesh it all so it like it's back to like proper polygons, and just swing it back into Max and boom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And who makes that first plugin you were talking about? Or
I don't actually know the guy's name, but I know online it's Hedus UV, so it's like HEADUS and then UV layout. I think that the indie or like the freelancer license is only like $135, so it's like super cheap, but it's extremely proficient piece of software.
Right. Well, 3 hours to 15 minutes, right? That pays for itself in one use right there. I mean, that's...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, I absolutely hate unwrapping. So, like, it literally does it all for me. And I just can trust that when I bring it in or when I texture it, that all the text identity is just equal across the mesh.
Very cool. So what's been your favorite game or project to work on?
So I think, you know, being a guy from Ireland, it definitely has to be PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, for the fact that PlayerUnknown, Brendan Green, is actually from Kildare.
I didn't know that.
It's funny because I remember when I was trying to get into the industry and I was like doing all-nighters on my portfolio, I remember coming across a PC Gamer article and it was like, they don't like these articles where it was like, hey, show us your like your desk, your setup, you know, and one of them was Brendan Green, and I was like, who the fuck's Brendan Green? And I found out that he was a guy in Kildare working remotely on H1Z1. I think he was like a design consultant. And I think it's just funny how life works, where it's literally 2 years later, I end up working on his project. You know, so yeah, I think just being from Ireland, it's that kind of little like pet project where it's something that I'll just always be like, no one had any idea it was going to be as successful as it was. No one seen success coming. So the fact that we all got to experience the huge explosion of just popularity in real time, it's definitely something that will probably stand with me for the rest of my life. You know, just look back at it like, wow, that game was just phenomenal.
Because you had that experience and you saw it happen. And then you've got that credit under your belt, you know, for the rest of your career and the rest of your life. That, you know, that's a game that you can say you worked on and everyone's like, oh, wow, you worked on that, you know, versus game, blah, blah, blah. And everyone's like, I don't know, what is that?
And it's funny, too, because it's like, you know, I've been in the industry for so long and I've worked in so many popular games from like Red Dead, Hitman and everything. And I come from a little town in Ireland where it's kind of like, you know, people don't really work in this industry. And a lot of people don't really work in this industry in Ireland, you know, and friends and my brothers would be like, oh, my brother worked on like PUBG or like Red Dead 2. And they're just like, what? Like, really? You know, and they come and ask me and they're like, hey, did you work on that? And because I've been doing it for so long now, it's just normal, you know, and it's a weird contrast.
Yeah. I've had that too, where it's just like, yeah, I worked in these games and stuff and people are just shocked by it. And it's just like, yeah, okay. You know, it's just like commonplace. And I don't know. It's weird because it's just, you don't think about it being so unusual. And people find it really exciting. But then I also find, like, when I talk to people who do things that I find exciting, like I have a buddy that's a lead engineer for a IndyCar racing team. And I'm just like, oh man, tell me about this and tell me about that. And he worked with Jimmy Vassar when he won the IndyCar championship and, you know, all those kind of things. And he's just like, yeah, you know, and he plays it down too. Like, it's no big deal, 'cause that's just his job. And that's what he's been doing for 25 years. And you know, he works on race cars and he travels around the world and it looks cool and sexy from the distance, but you know, when you do it, it doesn't seem so crazy just because that's what you do, right? So
yeah, exactly. You know, I'm making game art for a living, but I still have days where I get up and I'm just like not bothered.
Yeah. Well, the Ireland thing is cool too. Like, let's kind of talk about the difference between, say, European and North American game development, because you have a lot of perspective on that, although it seems like a lot of your games have been published in North America initially or North American publishers. But yeah, kind of talk about the difference between North America and Europe.
Sure. So, I mean, for the time that I've worked on projects based in Europe, I think the most stark difference that stands out is the pace of production on a project. European,
also,
in the kind of in the sense that European studios kind of seem to be a bit more relaxed from what I've experienced, and I kind of find American studios to be a bit more like go, especially when it comes to like feedback adjustments and stuff for work. They're kind of like a bit more, you know, this needs to be done now, you know. And it, for me, it's totally cool because I kind of just work better in that sense. But for European studios, they just always seem to be just a bit more relaxed. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it could be a cultural thing too. You know, especially depending on the company and the publisher and where they are in the North America, people tend to be kind of more go, high stress and things like that. I mean, I remember working a long time ago on a puzzle game called Zoop, and we had like 9 platforms. We had to launch them all simultaneously, and there was a little developer in the UK called Hookstone, and it was up against the wire. And of course, you're trying to make it out for Thanksgiving, and we need changes done, and we were dealing with the developer in the UK, and it was just like, hey, we got to get stuff done. When are we going to get the update? And they're like, sorry, mate, you know, it's 5 o'clock. It's Friday, you know. And it's like, what? I'm like, I don't care if it's pub time. It's like, you know, we got to get these changes made. These cartridges have to go out. And it was just like a clash of perspectives, because we were so close to the end. For me, it was like, I'll just do this one more thing. And for them, they're like, it's pub time, man. What are you asking me for, you crazy Americans? So I can relate to that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, it's weird because I find culturally I get on much, much better with Americans. For some reason, I just, any like UK studio I've worked with, I've had some sort of like friction in some kind of regard, you know. But with Americans, yeah, I just seem to click with 100%, and I'm kind of like work in the same mindset, and you know, I work US dollars, so it's,
oh, okay.
Yeah, it took me to kind of work from like, here it would be kind of like 1 p.m. to like, at the very latest I've ever had to work is 1 p.m. to 4 a.m. you know, but mm-hmm. it works better for me because I'm more productive in the evening, so it kind of, it complements the hours than the US company yeah. being online.
Well, yeah. Yeah, if you're a night owl, you know, that fits your rhythm, right? And then, the closer you are working remote to U.S. hours makes it less painful about like, oh, no, we got to wait, you know, to the next day to get that thing from James now, versus like, oh, I can ping him on Slack here and, you know, we'll get it in an hour or two. So it makes it more seamless that you're remote, and it's not always like, wait till the next day. I remember working at a company where we had a QA in India, but they actually worked West Coast hours because it just made that iteration easier and quicker versus the 1 day time delays when things are on the edge there, things like that.
Exactly.
What about difference in marketplace, like games Americans like versus games Europeans like? And obviously there are those that are universal, the PUBGs and the Red Deads and things. But what thoughts do you have just about the two different markets and different tastes in games, I guess?
So, you know, for me, from my experience so far, it's kind of hard to see that. I think there's definitely one thing that stands out, and that's that Creative Assembly, the Total War franchise, I think it's more popular in Europe and the UK. I've not really encountered anyone from the US who plays Total War, but again, maybe I just haven't, you know, come across that person. But for the most part, I think the other projects seem to be pretty seamless. You know, the markets, I mean, I worked on Sea of Thieves, and that's pretty big in both markets. You know, PUBG, Hitman, maybe, I'm not sure. I haven't really seen much activity with Hitman in the US, but again, it could just be a sense of not having exposure to, you know, the US market playing Hitman.
Yeah.
Seems to be more European.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Hitman probably has got more of a European following. Sea of Thieves was pretty well received over here. And yeah. There are those ones that are just universal, and then there's like, you know, the cricket games or the F1 games and things like that that are more for one market. And then some of these, you know, American games, I'm sure there's not as many or a ton of people in Europe playing, say, Madden football or something, although, yeah, you know, they play over there now. So maybe it's starting to grow. But yeah, there are definitely cultural differences between genres.
Definitely.
I worked for Blue Byte way back in the past, and we would do turn-based strategy games. And the Battle Isle series was very, very popular in Europe. And, you know, we did it as over here in the States as incubation, times running out, sold like 5,000 copies, and nobody really cared, unfortunately. Although it won, you know, turn-based strategy game of the year in 1997. But yeah, there's, you know, turn-based strategy games generally have a bigger following in Europe and especially Germany. But again, it's just flavors, tastes, sensibilities for certain genres. Other ones are universal.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, I think the most, the marketplace stands out the most is the Asian, like the Japanese, you know, marketplace. I mean, it's pretty easy to see that the majority of Japanese games probably wouldn't do very well in like the US or European market, except for the exceptions being like Metal Gear Solid. And then you have like PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds that was done in Korea. But I think that was initially the South Koreans pushed to try and get into the West market, which was PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
Yep. So what about potential threats do you see to the industry and along with opportunities?
So in terms of threats, I'm not entirely sure. I think we might hit a time where a lot of things will become automated. You know, I can kind of maybe see that happening more in like code and design, you know, and that kind of then puts people out of work. I think on the art front, you know, maybe with how photogrammetry is going, I kind of be a little worried that we get to a point where we just scan all our props. We don't make props anymore. You know,
right.
We have an application that scans and optimizes them and creates a texture set, and then you just import it. And that's like asset artist side of, you know, jobs. That's my only kind of worry. Regarding opportunities, I think on the flip side, you know, with the new technology coming up, like, you know, photogrammetry, it opens a lot more job opportunities in studios for people to, you know, specifically specialize in these areas.
No, that's interesting. And I did a previous podcast with Dave Grace, and he was talking about, you know, on the animation side, he sees some concerns there with different machine learning and things like that, and ways to automate animation more, where if you're an animator, you know, maybe you're in a little bit of trouble there. And then, there's always the outsourcing too, right?
Yeah.
And when you're competing just based on cost, you know, there's other parts of the world that by competing on cost, you know, can do it for just so much cheaper than you can, say, in Europe or North America. So yeah, those are challenges too.
You know, I mean, I think it's literally like, I remember hearing like one European or one US artist is the equates to three Indian artists. That's why outsource is extremely popular in India. So I think, you know, you have that battle, you know, and then, you know, as a freelancer, you know, artists in studios are becoming less and less because the majority of the art gets outsourced to like outsource vendors or freelancers. And you have a very small knitted art team in the studio that basically take all that, bring them into the world and optimize where they can. You know, I remember talking with John Romero down at his studio one day, and we were talking about like just art and kind of like the different, I guess, opportunities in the industry. And he was saying to me, you know, like, you know, you could hire an asset artist, but then when all the assets are done for the world and made, you know, like, they're kind of like, okay, well, why are you still here? You know, so it's like, you'll often find that the increase of outsource will grow more and more, you know, as the projects get a lot larger as well. I mean, you have like for your typical AAA, you probably have like four or five outsource studios working on it. And then like an art team with maybe 30 internally. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. And it used to be, that would be hundreds of artists internally at that studio. And yeah, you're totally right. It's more the internal people are giving the art direction and management and things. And then it scales up and down based on demand, and then using, you know, outsourcing studios and individuals like yourself. So yeah, I think the days of, you know, hundreds of fellow artists working at one studio or one company are going down more and more.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, even with what happened with Blizzard and the whole Activision layoff, I mean, you know, we've really hit a point in the industry where there is no job security. And I think working as a freelancer in some ways gives you more job security than working in the studio. You know, and I always explain to people, like, when you're a freelancer, it's like a hydra head. You know, you've got many heads of income, and if one goes, you're fine. You know, if you're working in a studio and you've signed a contract that has a non-compete clause, you're relying on that singular income every month. And if that's cut, you know, that causes a lot of trouble. So,
Yeah, you can be more nimble as a freelancer and have multiple projects going at once. And I know a lot of times it tends to be feast or famine. So sometimes there are droughts, but then when there are the feast parts, then you just keep really busy. And then, you know, building up your portfolio and making connections and doing all those kind of things so that you can lay the groundwork for future projects. And yeah, it is a much easier commitment for, you know, a company or a studio to bring on a freelancer to do some assets versus that commitment of a full-time salary and benefits and reviews and all those kind of things. So yeah, there are challenges around that.
And I think that one of the pros of that is being a freelancer is you can essentially earn more, you know, like if you have multiple clients, you know, you're not working in a studio, you're not getting the benefits and entitlements or like the year contracts of 12 months of work, you know, you can have two or three clients and you can basically just like, all right, I'm going to like crank these rates up, you know, and you basically get, essentially you can put yourself in a position where you have enough buffer for 12 months of savings. So regardless, you kind of build a nest of a year contract worth of, you know, income. Yeah. So there's definitely a lot of benefits.
Yeah, for sure. So what about thoughts on AR and or VR?
So I haven't had much experience with AR. I think the most I've ever had with AR is using Snapchat and having like, those little silly like 3D models of like the hot dog with the buns on it, just like dancing and whatnot. But I think the most of it has kind of been through VR. I definitely see VR. I think that we're still in the early days, but I would love to see it sort of grow to the point where you literally have like maybe, you know, you have like your senses. So maybe you can smell stuff, or maybe when you get shot, you kind of feel like a vibration or just more immersion. But I mean, I still put on a VR headset every day when I'm working on one of my projects, and I'm just like, wow, you know, it's like you forget how immersive it becomes. You know, you don't see the room you're in, you just see the world, and you look down and you're just like, holy crap. But, you know, I would love to see it expand more. I would love to see it become more of a commercial, not necessarily commercial, but more accessible to people who can't afford an Oculus Rift or a PlayStation VR. Maybe it just becomes the next standard sort of platform to play games on. You know, there is no more PC gaming with a keyboard and mouse or a console with a controller. It's literally like you have a box and a VR headset and VR controllers, and that's just, I think it would open a lot of interesting opportunities, especially with like playing with your friends, you know. I'd definitely love to see it grow.
I said over and over, I'm just kind of really excited and curious about how the Oculus Quest does, just because of the price point and the accessibility and the lack of high-end computers and monitors. And I meant not even the cameras and all the cables and stuff like that. But tell me a little bit about developing art on VR. Like, do you find you have to take more breaks, or you get headaches, or, you know, I'm just trying to think about, you know, wearing the headset to review things and if there are differences or not, you know, between doing stuff.
There definitely is. I mean, I find one of the differences, like when you're testing it, you have to wear the VR set and you have to navigate around the map and such. And I find after wearing a VR headset for very long, you kind of, it's like your eyes become sort of square. Like you take it off and you're just like, what? You know, it's hard to like kind of get back to where you're at.
Yeah.
I think you have to optimize a lot more for some weird reason. And to this day, I still don't understand in my head how you can have an extremely powerful computer, but yet you have to keep everything super simple in VR because it just doesn't run performantly otherwise. But yeah, like you're essentially, you would pretty much, you know, you take your standard AAA quality and you pretty cut it by 50% if you wanted to perform a VR project.
Yeah, and just to jump in there, I think part of that too is you've got to run it, you know, frame rate, right? So you have to ideally be running there at 60, and then because you've got two screens, you know, then that's, you know, 120. So that really eats into the performance. And, you know, when you're not running at a steady, fast frame rate, then that causes nausea and dizziness and things like that. It makes it a lot harder on the players. So, yeah, even though you have like this big, crazy, powerful computer, then having to run, you know, two screens at 60 chops into all the options you have, because that's just such a threshold that you have to stay above.
Exactly. And I find when you're developing for VR, if you literally like, if you're in like Unreal Editor, for example, and you have like the development build open and you jump into a map and some coder or whatnot's made changes and you put the headset on, you start looking around and it's chopping like crazy with the frame rate. Like it definitely very quickly makes you feel sick. So.
Yeah. And you're like, I gotta go walk around and get some fresh air here and get away from this. So what game are you playing right now that you're excited about or that you've, say, played recently?
Sure. So looking at my library, I think the most played game at the moment is probably Insurgency Sandstorm. It's totally not biased, but it's definitely one of the best FPS games I've played so far.
Who makes that?
So there's a studio in Denver called New World Interactive. They have a smaller satellite studio in Amsterdam, and they are now opening another studio in Calgary. They're primarily just a US company, and they pretty much work on Insurgency Sandstorm, which is a tactical FPS shooter with kind of a more of an arcade feel rather than realist, like more tactical, you know, slow pace. One thing that makes it really exciting for me is just the sound design is just absolutely phenomenal. Like, I'm not sure how the sound designers actually produced the sounds, but it literally is just so real and so well done to pretty much movie quality, where you're playing it and you get extremely stressed when you're under fire because the sounds are just so realistic.
Yeah. Sound can add a lot of tension and drama to things and stuff. Speaking of sound, I'm going to do a shameless plug here. Our new Cardio X game is the first game we developed at Level X that has a full-time sound designer working on it. And he created a soundtrack also that's on Spotify now for the game. That's a lot of ambient and techno and just really cool music, even some metal tracks in there. And it's really wild how, sound does make such a huge difference, you know, in not just, you know, arcade or console or PC, but even mobile games. So I'll put a link to the show notes for the Cardio X soundtrack. Pretty cool stuff. Okay, what about a funny or odd story from working in the game industry that you can share that you won't get in trouble for?
I think probably the one funny story from working in the industry is probably when I was working at Rockstar, we had the whole Lindsay Lohan lawsuit happening. And
what was that about?
So essentially, Grand Theft Auto V, there was a concept drawing of a character for the loading screen. And it was like this blonde girl with a very prominent body and like a red bikini with sunglasses. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, Lindsay Lohan thought that was her, and basically Rockstar are making money off her by doing a sketch of her, which is just absolute BS. And basically, during my time working
on... Well, she was drunk in her defense. No, I'm just kidding.
So basically, when I was working on Red Dead Redemption 2, we pretty much just like, you know, that whole rigmarole was going on, and it was just funny to kind of like have an insight to it and kind of just hear people's opinions and whatnot of it. And then, of course, she lost the lawsuit because she had absolutely no ground to stand on. So that was the first time I've ever kind of experienced, well, not only something funny, but sort of the relation of how, you know, such a huge game can kind of end up in such a weird lawsuit like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, something gets huge and then people are kind of like, you know, try to glom onto it and get their piece of the pie. So yeah, I just looked it up here now about the GTA 5, maybe because she was being arrested and she had sunglasses on that claims that was her. What's funny too, when I typed up Lindsay Lohan lawsuit, it showed other lawsuits. So yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that says a lot.
Yeah. She's got bills, you know, but no, that's funny. Cool. So where can people find you on online, website, Twitter, stuff like that?
Yeah. So like under the name Brady Art, which my website is just brittyart.xyz. I'm on LinkedIn as well, which is just James Brady, but in the header being Brady Art. Typically kind of like any podcast or anything I've done is kind of like the holder name that people can find me on. Like if you just type Brady Art into Google, maybe one of the projects I've worked on after it, then they'll probably be able to find like the publications, the podcast, my website, and perhaps my LinkedIn as well.
Yeah. You have an amazing career for a relatively, you know, short period of time in the industry. If 2015 to now, to have all these titles under your belt is very impressive. And I'm sure people are going to be continuing to hire you and reaching out to you. So I'll have all this info in the show notes. And James, it's been great. Is there anything else you want to say or bring up or share?
No, I can't think of anything at the moment.
Okay. Well, cool. Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. If you found it interesting or helpful, please leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to subscribe. I have a lot of great episodes coming out. As always, I want to hear from you, the game development community. So give me a call at 224-484-7733 or reach out on the website, gamedevadvice.com. I want to know your struggles, your questions, and your ideas. Since the podcast is really about you, the fellow game developer, and our game development community. Thanks and take care.